Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players, uncover their stories, and discover what makes them tick. If you love guitar, music, and the backstory of people's lives, stick around. You're in the right place. If you're enjoying this show and you'd like to support it, go to everyonelovesguitar.com/support. And for information on advertising, visit everyonelovesguitar.com/advertise. Are you looking to buy or sell a home in the Tampa Bay area without having to deal with pushy realtors? Then make sure you connect with West Florida Real Estate. West Florida Real Estate has helped over 300 homeowners and investors buy and sell their properties over the last 5 years. Their service is outstanding, just like back in the days when there was actually service in the service business, and you'll never have to deal with any kind of sales junk when you're working with them. For more information, email Ann with an E at westfloridarealestate.com. That's A-N-N-E at westfloridarealestate.com. Hey, everybody, this is Craig Garber. Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, and we're going to show some love to the rhythm section today. I've got literally one of the finest, most seasoned, coolest guys, drummers in Nashville. We're with the one and only Greg Morrow. This guy has got a resume. I mean, I'm just going to touch, this is the iceberg I'm going to even talk about, man, but there's a whole mess of stuff underneath there.
You know what icebergs do? They sink ships.
Well, you're floating ships, man. I know that. A couple of quick announcements. Make sure you go to everyonelovesguitar.com/subscribe and subscribe to the audio and the YouTube channel. And if you are watching this on YouTube, hit the subscribe button and the little bell there. All righty, Greg Morrow, first call session and touring drummer out of Nashville for well over 20 years. Is it 20 or 30?
20, let's see, what year is this? It's 24 years, be 24 years in August of this year.
Right on, 24 years. He grew up in Memphis, and at age, the ripe old age of 11, he participated in his first recording session.
Yeah, sure did.
In the, what was that?
We were going to be on a little local TV show there called Swing Shift, which ironically was an R&B show that came on Friday nights about 11 p.m. And the host was named Harry Winfield. And
man, what a memory you got from 11. Well, that's pretty impressive.
Leave a mark, for that. And anyway, so, back in those days, you went to a studio and did your dub tape, because you were going to lip sync, on the TV show. And we went to a little studio called Sonic Recording, which was owned by Roland James. If you know Roland from Sun, right. Roland, he worked at Sun, played guitar, was a guitarist there and engineered there, played on Jerry Lee Lewis records and Billy Lee Riley and the Little Green Men. And Roland was, he was an amazing guy, amazingly talented guy, and always had studios. And so he did the first session I ever did was at his studio. And, we went in and set up and there were no headphones and we cut straight to mono, singing and playing live all at the same time. With no monitoring at all. So we just kind of had to blend ourselves on the floor and let him grab what he could. And actually for what we were, it was okay. It was okay for a bunch of punk kids.
For 11-year-olds. Hell yeah, man.
Yeah. Yeah.
In the 80s, Greg toured and recorded with the commercially successful Christian band DeGarmo and Key. And he was then part of Amy Grant's touring band. In 96, Greg moved to Nashville, and again, this is literally a tiny tip of the iceberg. He's played on records with the following artists, Blake Shelton, Don Henley, Joe Bonamassa, Billy Gibbons, Bob Seger, Steve Earle, Sonny Landreth, 38 Special. Did you play with Jeff Carlisi by any chance?
No, Jeff wasn't in the band then.
That's what I thought. John Jorgensen, who I had on here, what a player. The Warren brothers. Guy. Yeah, I had Brad Warren on here. He's got a good story, too. Funny guy. Brooks and Dunn, Darius Rucker, Vince Gill, Steve Warner, who we had on here, Reba McEntire, Deanna Carter, Leanne Rimes, Cindy Lauper. I've had a ton of her musicians on here. Did you play with, who was the bass player on that gig?
On that session, let's see, I'm trying to remember. It was a real quick session. Jimmy Lee Sloss.
Oh, okay.
Session, yeah. It was that little, she came to Nashville to do, really, she wanted to do some legit kind of country music. And one of the things I played on was a duet with she and Vince. And it was fun. She was really sweet. And, you know, man, she came through town the next year opening for Rod Stewart. And she called everybody on that date and offered them tickets to the show.
Wow, that's really nice.
She just said, I wanted to thank you for what you did on the record. And if anybody wants to come out, I want to have, you know, anybody that wants to come, please come. And my wife and I went and she brought it too. She was great live. Golly, Bill.
What a nice, kind. I mean, nobody does that. That's unheard of.
No, it was a level of thoughtfulness you don't see much anymore.
That's nice, man. Warren Haynes, which I'll ask you about, he's coming on here soon. Haddon Sayers, he's coming on here in a few weeks, man. I'll ask you about that, too.
I've known Haddon a long, long time.
Nice guy, yeah. Trisha Yearwood, the Dixie Chicks, and literally hundreds of other people. Greg's also a member of Big Al Anderson's band, Al from NRBQ, of course. They're called the World Famous Headliners. And along with Big Al, Pat McLaughlin, Sean Camp, and Michael Rhodes on bass, the band, Greg has, that's part of the World Famous Headliners. And Greg has won Academy of Country Music Drummer of the Year Award twice. Man, thank you so much. It's so good to talk with you.
Well, thank you. Thanks for asking.
My pleasure, man. So how did you start playing at 11? Were you like a musical family or?
Well, you know, actually, I started playing a lot earlier than that. I think I got my first real made out of wood drum set when I was about 6 or 7.
Oh, wow.
And it did start with my family. I was thinking about that this morning because I thought this might come up, but, on my dad's side of the family, but it was on both sides of the family, but my grandfather on my dad's side had a little arch top Wabash guitar that he got from Montgomery Ward mail order catalog or something. And that was probably the first instrument I ever physically touched in my life. And he would play it when I was a little tiny boy. He'd play it and just kind of moan around, you know, and stomp his foot and play guitar, you know, finger pick a little bit. And my dad's little brother, my Uncle Dale, was a teenager when I was born, and he had, he had records, and I was going to say he had a record collection, but you wouldn't really call it a collection at the time. It was just a handful of records. They were dirt poor. But he wound up having these records, and he would play these records. When I was 3 and 4 years old, he would have his little record player out and be playing these records. And it was Fats Domino and Elvis and Jerry Lee and Little Richard. And I just remember, you know, the Little Richard records in particular. If that doesn't work your monkey nerve, you're not.
Yeah, man, you're dead.
If that doesn't just drive you into just a frenzy.
Yeah.
And so it was all of that stuff. And both sides of the family sang in church, you know, sang in quartets or trios. And so there was a lot of music around. None of them were ever like musicians as far as doing this for a living or anything, but there was always music around because it was a free commodity. You know, it was something you created yourself, you know, you didn't have to buy it.
So they were probably really supportive when you wanted to go into music as a career.
Not exactly. Not exactly. No, my dad took him a long, long, long time to come to terms with it. He.
What did he do? What kind of work did your dad do?
He was in the cotton business. Right. He worked right downtown, right on the river in Memphis, and he worked for a company called Wheel Brothers Cotton. And he had gotten this job when he and my mom got married. He had gotten this job. His uncle GT worked at this cotton company and got him on down there. And he wound up, he would go around, he had a company station wagon, and he would drive all around the Delta, picking up cotton samples from all the gins in the area, you know, cotton's king. And he would come back, I mean, at station wagon full from the back window to the back of the front seats, stuffed to the ceiling with, you know, cotton samples. And he would take them back to the, you know, to the office there and grade them. Okay. They'd have to grade them and categorize them and figure out what they wanted to buy for what, you know? And so that was his business. That's what he did for a living.
Wow. That sounds like something from a million years ago today, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
That's
it
wild. That's mm-hmm. really cool. It's interesting. When you said earlier, before we started recording, I said, do you read a lot, or do you a writer? Because you speak very colorfully, and you said a lot of that's from the South. And then you mentioned the Delta. I have a guy coming on my show. He's actually a best-selling author. He's written 5 books, and he's from the Delta. And all of his books, I've read 2 of them now, take place there. And the language is very colorful, just like what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a cool...
What's his name?
Michael Farris Smith.
Huh.
Great. I mean, 5 books best-selling. He is from Oxford, Mississippi.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, Faulkner.
Yeah. Right. And right. He talks about that, and he has a little bio in there. And it's just me being a guy from New York City, I can feel the, you know, the cultural vibe. And it's so cool to I imagine it's so cool to have grown up in a place like that where you have all this color in life going on.
Yeah, it's different. It's not to wax philosophic here, but I mean, that's one of the beauties of us as a nation.
Yeah.
The Northeast is not like the South, is not like the West, is not like the Midwest. And that's what gives us our unique qualities and perspectives that we share with each other.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, it's a shame that even to this day, you still have people going, well, he's just a dumb old Southern redneck. It's like, well,
I know, man. It's really weird.
Yeah.
I know. In 2020, I know.
It's just crazy. But yeah, I got to say, I consider I had a charmed, very blessed raising in West Tennessee and along the Mississippi River, and just, you know, getting to run up and down Mississippi and Louisiana and just being, you know, it's formative to me.
It's
just as, you know, New York is formative to you. You know, we carry those things with us through our lives. And
right on. That's it. That's it, man. Even whether you love it or hate it, it's a part of you, man. And it's shaped, you know, a lot of your meter inside who you are, man.
Sure.
Okay. So how did you first get started in the actual music business, and what was your first break?
Well, you know, all through high school and all that stuff, I was in working bands. I made playing, literally starting, I guess, my freshman year of high school. We stayed pretty busy, and there was a Navy base in Millington, which was a great gig to have, because they'd book you for week-long stints, and the money was, at the time, really good. I think we come home with $300 a man a week, but that was in 19...
Oh, my God. God,
1972.
That's a boatload of money.
Yeah, that's a boatload of money for a 13, 14 year old kid.
That's probably 50 years ago. That's probably $1,500. I mean, $1,000 at least.
It was great money. So you'd love to have those Navy base gigs.
Yeah.
And then also that same area, they had regular little, you know, regular nightclubs too. So if you weren't playing on the base, you'd just go play the clubs, you know, where the ruffians would come. But that was fun. So, you know, I mean, just literally from the time I could be out there playing and could get myself to gigs and back, I was a gigging drummer. And man, it just kind of never stopped. It just kind of took little steps and little steps and little steps. And I guess you would say my first, what you would call a break. There was a guy, it was a band in Memphis called Larry Raspberry and the High Steppers. And Larry had been in a band called the Gentries in the 60s. They had a top five hit with a song called Keep On Dancing. So he was very well thought of, and, you know, he was a very successful Memphis musician. He was one of those guys. And I have to back up a little bit, because when I was to kind of frame this story, when I was a sophomore in high school, they had a record come out. They were on Enterprise, which was supposed to be the rock leg of Stax Records, was supposed to be Enterprise. They had a record come out on Enterprise, and we were driving home from my grandparents one night, and I had convinced my dad to listen to FM 100, which was the rock station in town. Well, there was a band playing live on the radio from Ardent Studios, and it was the High Steppers, and they were performing their album in the studio in front of like 50 people, you know, and being broadcast live with her. And I remember hearing this and thinking, man, this is great. I love this. This is really cool. So I went and bought the record, you know, and became a big fan of the record. Well, I guess later that summer.
So well, this was probably
74.
Mid 70s. Yeah. Okay. You said FM radio. So I'm thinking, yeah.
Jackson, Tennessee, which is about 60 miles due east of Memphis, the home of rockabilly, they call it, because Carl Perkins from there.
Oh, I don't know.
But anyway, they decide they're going to have a big rock festival in the summer in Jackson, Tennessee. And it's Blue Oyster Cult and Nazareth, and Kiss is supposed to be there. It's just when the first year Kiss was around. Well, anyway, we show up to this rock festival in Jackson, Tennessee, and it's at the Rodeo Arena. You know, dry, dusty, just horrible, you know, oh my gosh, the setting was just, it was just horrible. We get there, we find out Kiss has decided they're not coming, but Nazareth is there and Blue Oyster Cult's there and a band from St. Louis called Pavlov's Dog, and Larry Raspberry and the High Steppers had been called to take Kiss's place.
Oh, right on for you.
On this show. So, I'm excited to see them. You know, I'm excited to see the band I like, right? Well, I shouldn't go into just all this, but it's just all logged into my brain. This thing just deteriorates through the day, right?
Oh, they, man.
It's the power is not substantial. It won't run. You know, they can't. Nazareth tries to start their set twice, and the power goes off at the same point in the first song twice in a row. So they bail, right? They bail. Pavlov Dog stumbles kind of through their set. They have a Mellotron that will not stay in tune because it doesn't have enough voltage. So they sound kind of horrible. They take a long break, and they get – someone goes and gets a civil defense generator, right, and brings it to the to the rodeo arena, and this is about late afternoon. So they get this thing fired up, and Blue Oyster Cult gets to play, and they play their whole set, and man, they just blew it up. They just, it was amazing. And this was when their third album had come out, and I was a big fan of them too.
You went with your buddies or your parents took you to the show?
My cousins.
Okay, that's cool.
Cousins. Yeah, I had older cousins. Anyway, so Blue Oyster Cult plays. And, you know, everybody's thinking, great. Well, by the time they finish, the sun's going down and there's no lights. So they're having to pull the plug on the festival. And I'm noticing over here at the side of the stage, Larry and the band have gotten their gear out of the truck, you know, because they're going to close the night, right? Well, the word comes down that the show's over. People lose their minds. They're throwing beer bottles and all this stuff. And I'm like, I run over to where Larry is as he's trying to load the van up. Said, Larry, man, my name's Greg. I'm from Memphis. I love you, Rick. And I'm just, you know, just rambling. I'm just running off at the mouth. Telling him how much I love his record and blah, 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 blah. And, you know, I've listened to it. I know all your songs. Blah, blah, blah. Anyway, you know, great kid. See you, you know, thanks for speaking. They're hauling butt, right? Well, fast forward about 2 or 3 years, and I, you know, I've been working at a music store there in town. I see Larry come in and out a few times, you know, so he kind of knows my face and, you know, remembers the event. Well, I'm in a band that's making pretty good money. We're playing up in East Tennessee, up in Knoxville area, and I get this phone call at the hotel room, and I'm answering for hello. It's just Greg. And I'm like, yeah. He said, well, this is Larry Raspberry. And I'm like, okay. He said, I hope you don't mind me tracking you down. He said, I had to call your parents to find out where you were.
That's fun.
They told me you were out of town. But he said, I found out who you are from Big Dave. He said, I went to the music store. I said, you know that kid that says he knows all my songs? Dave said, yeah, I know. He said, what's his phone number? Well, come to find out, Chad Cromwell was playing with Larry at the time, and they had 2 weeks left on a tour, and Chad was going to have to bail on the tour. He had to have surgery.
Oh man.
Larry was looking for anybody to come fill these 2 weeks.
Wow.
And he finally got down to me and tracked me down in Knoxville on a Saturday afternoon. And so we play the gig on Saturday. I drive home Sunday, I repack all my drums, and he's got me an airline ticket to Madison, Wisconsin on a Monday. And so I fly to Madison with my entire drum kit as checked baggage.
Oh my God.
Can you imagine
that?
No. It was like 13 pieces of checked baggage. All my drum kit. Anyway, they fly me up there. We rehearse one time, and I play the next 2 weeks with him. And I consider that my kind of break into, okay, these guys have a record, blah, blah, you know what I'm saying? And I wound up staying in the band. And this was actually before DeGarmo and Key, just before DeGarmo and Key. And we, you know, we wound up, like I said, I wound up staying with the band. That's where I met Brig Nadello.
Oh, was he in the band too?
He was out there on that tour.
Oh, that is nice, man. Yeah, so there's you guys with the rhythm section.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Oh, that's awesome, man.
He was on that tour. We stayed together, stayed in the band. We wound up getting a record deal with Mercury and doing a record there in Memphis for Mercury Records. And like I said, all of that was right before the Garland Cube. So.
Man, what a great story. What was it? Larry Raspberry and the Drifters?
The High Steppers.
And the High Steppers. That's so cool. For people listening, Greg was talking about Mike Brignadello, great bass player. If you haven't heard his interview, check it out. He was on the show a while, but lovely guy. And just like Greg, a pedigree resume. His last name is Brignadello, Brignadello. So if you haven't heard that one, that's
like he told their manager, he changed it to that. that was his original family name. His dad had shortened it to Briggs. And when he got married, he wanted to take the family name back. So he put it back to Brignadello.
Oh, I didn't know. That's cool, man.
And when he was with Giant, he would tell the story about Bud Prager calling him into the office. And he's thinking, oh, God, I'm getting fired already. He said, Mike, we got to talk about the name. what about the name? He said, Brignadello, what am I supposed to do with that? He said, yeah, Bud, I changed it to that. Yeah,
that's great. Yeah, that's right. He was with
Giant. What am I going to do with you?
That's cool, man. Oh, that's nice that you guys played together. What What prompted you to move to Nashville? And once you first got to town, how did you kind of get started? Because, you know, that's a tough town to break into.
Well, it is tough. The prompting, it was just getting tougher and tougher to get anywhere in Memphis. I had a studio down there, and we would literally, that's where, oddly enough, Haddon Sayers would come and do records at my studio in Memphis.
That's wild.
And, but you know, it was just hunt and peck. It was like a chicken pecking, you know, feed out in the field. I mean, you just would just keep your head down looking for any scrap of work to do. And, you know, if you wanted to play four gigs a week, you better have at least three bands to do it.
Oh, right.
And it just, you know, it was just getting tougher and tougher and tougher. My daughter was getting ready to start school. And I had a few opportunities to come up and do a couple of things. I met a guy up here named Bobby Fields, R.S. Field, that, you know, produced Sonny and Webb Wilder and some folks like that. And he brought me up to do some recording on a Webb Wilder record. And
I had Webb on the show. He's another nut.
I love Webb.
He's a funny guy. Yeah.
He's fun as hell to play with. Dude. I mean, to play his gigs is just a blast. But anyway, Norbert Putnam had brought me up to play on a couple of things.
Why do I know that name? He's a big time producer, isn't he?
Yeah, he was one of the very original Shoals guys with Rick Hall and all that.
Okay. He
played with Elvis and, you know, produced Dan Fogelberg and Jimmy Buffett. And I mean, Norbert's the real deal. He's the real deal. Anyway, I had met him. I'd met him in Memphis, cutting some stuff with Jimmy Webb, songwriter Jimmy Webb.
Yeah, I know who that is.
And it just, you know, every now and again out of the blue, he'd call me and ask me to do something. We just kind of hit it off. And anyway, I had my toe dipped in the water, I guess you would say.
Sure.
But I didn't have enough going on to really make a move. So I probably in 94, I rented a room in a friend of mine's house and got a little phone line. You know, the perception is reality.
Yeah, yeah. So
they can call a local number and leave you a message. In their mind, you're there.
Sure.
Whether you're in Memphis or not. But I would just try to spend as much time up here as I could. And you know, it's just like anything else. I was fortunate because I did have some friends that had come from Memphis. You know, Brignar had come up here long before I did, and a songwriter named Trey Bruce, and they were all very involved in things. And they would tell me, man, you know, this is something you could do, but you know, you got to commit to it. If you're going to do it, you can do it, but you just got to commit to it.
Right.
You know, it was just a slight bit serendipitous. Along this same time, Chad had done a couple of showcases with Faith Hill, whose first album was just getting ready to come out, and they were looking to put together a band. They had been having some auditions, and they hadn't found who they wanted in the drum chair yet. And I got a call from her producer, Scott Hendricks, that Chad Cromwell had told him, you know, you should call this guy in Memphis and see if he might want to come up and audition. So he sent me some material, and I came up and played, and they offered me that chair. And so that, you know, that was a good immersion in the local show enough around town, Nashville. You know, that was a Nashville producer and a Nashville record and a Nashville act. And ironically enough, we were the third act on the bill on a Reba tour, you know.
Oh.
We wind up working for her later as well. But anyway, it was just all of that, you know, all those things kind of happened. And like I said, I still lived in Memphis at the time. And I remember really the thing that lit the fuse. I remember one night after a Faith show, and Scott was out with us. He called me to the back of the bus, and it was one of those things. You think you automatically go to the worst. Oh, crap, what have I done? I'm getting fired. You know,
right. I think that's normal. I don't know. We all do that, man. Right. You never go back and think, man, this is going to be great. I'm getting a raise. Like, why don't we think of that? Because we have that choice.
Never let yourself go there. Anyway, I go back there, and he said, man, you know, I just got to tell you. And I always credit him for this. He said, you don't need to be doing this. And I said, what? He said, man, this is going to do what it's going to do, but you need to come to Nashville. He said, you can make records. You can be one of those guys up here. And, but you know, you need to come on up. You need to make that commitment and come on up. He said, I can't tell you I'll hire you for everything I ever do. I may never hire you, but I know you can do this. And I just think you need to make that decision. Wow. And I guess that's really kind of gave me the confidence to, you know, to do it. And you know, plus the thing about, you know, everything changing in Memphis, and, you know, life changes with daughter starting school and all that stuff. And so we started looking for houses and looking for neighborhoods, and, you know, it all fell into place pretty quickly once we started look. We were very blessed, man. We try to live very faithfully and trust in that, and trust in that spiritual guidance and stuff. And we feel like we were just put right, literally exactly in the spot we needed to be, because we had great neighbors that loved our daughter.
Wow.
And, you know, my wife traveled for a living. She was a flight attendant, and I was still traveling some. So we needed extra help, and we had it on three sides of in our neighborhood. And it just, you know, the school couldn't have been any better. The neighborhood couldn't have been, nothing could have been any better in where we landed. And so, you know, I'm just so thankful for that. I'm grateful for it. But, you know, and once, you know, once we landed up here, man, it hit the on ramp, and we're cruising at 75. And, you know, the first couple of things I'm doing in town are, you know, strawberry wine and one way ticket with Leanne Rimes. Both of them went to number one. And, you know, when that happens for you, people feel safe to call you because they know you're not going to blow up the date.
Yeah.
The first two things you've played on have been huge successes. And, you know, so they know it ain't going to be your fault. You're not going to ruin the record.
Well, the opposite is going to happen, man. You're going to enhance the record. You know, that's why they're going to call you. Yeah.
You know, I got to say, the first real shown walked into a room of people I didn't know at all. And they were every one of them. It was Brent Rowan and John Hobbs and Biff Watson and Larry Franklin and Dan Dugmore and Joe Chimay. And I'm walking in there. I'm not the guy they're used to seeing behind the drum kit.
All right. I had Biff on the show. He's a nice guy, man.
And I'm sorry.
I had Biff on the show. He's a very nice guy.
Yeah. Biff's a great guy. And we developed a really good friendship over the years, but you know, this is the first time they're seeing me at all. So, you know, I'm not going to say it was a cold room. It wasn't a cold room, but it was very much a wait and see room.
Yeah, sure. Which is normal.
It is normal. I didn't begrudge them that at all. Yeah, you know, but then I just did, you know, I just tried to do what I thought was right. And, you know, they warmed up.
Man, what a nice, nice story. Thank you so much for sharing that. I got goosebumps when you told the whole thing, man. That was really cool. Let me ask you a couple of questions. So your wife was totally supportive of that as well.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. I'm curious about this because it's something I've learned only recently in the last 5 years. You said, you know, you've always been faith-based. You always had trust that God or the universe or whoever that spirit was for you was looking out for you, basically.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's, yeah.
I will say for me, I'm very much a believer, and I'm a Christian, and I was raised in the church.
Okay.
It has always been a part of my life that I never doubted it.
Sure, sure.
And it's not really saying it right, but it's always been reality to me.
Sure, I understand.
And I know I've had times where I fought it being the guiding principle, but I know it is the guiding principle of my life, and I'm glad, I'm glad it is. I don't think humans are superficial beings. I think they're deeper than just flesh, and then when you die, you're gone, and you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. What I admire about that is the people I've spoke to 700 people, pretty close to that now. And the people that have been open, like, it's almost like it's like everything else in life. If whatever you believe, that's what happens to you, sort of. So you always had this mindset that, the God is going to take care of me.
If I'll listen.
If you, right. Well, that's the other part too. But that's part of being open. You can't say like, well, God's going to take care of me and I'm going to pay attention to the stuff I want to pay attention to.
No.
That's not being open, man. That's being like, selfish kind of in a way.
That's one from column A, one from column B.
Yeah. But I always liked that because I was not a guy that was open to that. I had a rough upbringing, so I wasn't like open to like anybody looking after me, let alone a spirit, But as I've become more open to that, and really listening, I find more things are less stress in my life.
Yeah.
There's
peace.
Beyond
understanding, as they say.
Yeah, and I really think that's cool. I admire, and I've had a lot of people on that were raised. You happen to know Doyle Dykes?
I've met him a time or two. Yeah.
Yeah. Now he was very immersed in the church. As a little kid, his dad was a pastor. He grew up in, as he said, the wrong side of the tracks in Jacksonville. So I've talked to a lot of people like that, and it's just very interesting for me who grew up in a totally different type of environment to hear that and to be more open to that, because I think it's helped me. And I'm not talking about religion. I'm talking about belief that there's a power greater than, not that there's anything wrong with religion, but that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about just belief that there's somebody looking out for you there if you're open to that.
Well, religion is a process. Religion is a process of exercising faith.
For some people.
But it's not the definition of faith.
No, for sure, man. Because you got a lot of people I have met over the course of my life that are really religious. And I'm like, you can't say that you're religious, whatever religion you are, and then be an asshole in your real life. I don't think that's compatible. I mean, I don't know much about this, but I think that that's not compatible.
Yeah. I know what you mean.
Thank you, man. That was a really cool story. I appreciate you sharing that, Greg. I'm going to mention some of the artists that you've worked with, and if you can talk about how you got the gig and any cool or interesting story about working with them, that would be cool. That would be great. Let's start with Billy Gibbons. I like when I mention a name and someone laughs, because it's going to be fun.
You would start with the character.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what, he's a piece of work. I've known Billy on the periphery for a long, long time because they did so much work in Memphis. And I used to sneak into the storeroom at Ardent, which was behind the Studio B control room where they would be working. I would sneak into the storeroom and listen to them work through the wall.
That's cool.
And then when the music would stop, I'd run out in the hall and see if I couldn't, you know, catch him in the hall and say hi and this, that, and the other thing. And so, I've known him a long time. I remember one time they were working on the album. It was going to be the El Loco album. It was after Deguelo, the album after Deguelo. And they were in Studio A, and I was wandering the halls. And Bill Hamm, you know, their
manager, kind of.
Yeah. Mm-hmm, their guy. He decided, for whatever reason, he wanted a copy of Deguelo. He didn't have a copy of it. They wanted to reference something off of there. So he, hey, boy. Yes, sir, Mr. Hamm. Man, take this $10 and go down to Pop Tunes and get me a cassette of Deguelo, would you? Sure, I will. So I run down to the record store, grab the cassette of Deguelo. I think it was like $7.98 plus tax, right? And he had given me a $10 bill. And I come back and I hand it to him, and I hand him like, you know, a $1.63 worth of change. He said, "Won't you just keep the change, boy?" Right. Thank you, sir.
Yeah, right.
Stuff like $1.63 in my pocket, you know.
That's cool, man.
Yeah, but anyway, so it was just one of those things with Billy. You know, he was around town a lot. He had girlfriends there, and you know, he loved to come to town. And how I really started working with him had to do with a soundtrack thing they were trying to get together from Dusk Till Dawn.
That movie. I remember that. Yeah.
You know, movie. They had to get a couple of things cut for that. And we're having some issues. And so my friend Joe Hardy, the late, great Joe Hardy, who's amazing engineer and worked with Gibbons. I guess he started with him on Afterburn, that album. And they were tight. So they got me to come down to Houston and help them with a couple of things for that soundtrack. And it just kind of started a relationship that goes on today.
That's nice.
And he's a sweet guy. He's a total piece of work, but a sweet guy.
On his last record?
I played on both of his solo records, yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's really cool. Did you tour with him?
No. No, he to Billy's credit, he knows what he needs, and when he's out doing that stuff, he needs style. And as you can see by my picture above your head right now, I do not represent style in any form or fashion.
Hey, me and you both.
and that's okay with me. I totally get it.
Uh-huh.
I totally get it.
So he had someone pimped out on stage with him, basically.
Well, I think Matt Sorum did the last tour with
him. Oh, okay. Cool. That's funny, man.
Matt's a good-looking man.
Yeah. Well, he comes from that world of, you know, being pimped out on stage, you know, and that's image absolutely. Is a big part of.
He's a great drummer. There's no doubt about it.
Absolutely.
It's all good.
That's cool, man. Any funny Billy stories that you could share without getting anybody in trouble?
I can tell you, don't ever go shopping with him because there's no limits to his credit cards.
Right.
And you will wind up, it's just amazing. It's just amazing what will show up sometimes when you least expect it. We'll be at the studio and trucks will come all day sometimes, dropping just madness, just boxes of madness off that he sees.
Like guitars or like a couch, you know?
It could be both. Or a guitar. I mean, it's just this unending stream of stuff that he acquires. It's
like furry coats or something like that. Yeah, all that weird stuff.
And going to eat, like if you go to eat, he'll order 2 big silver serving pans full of tamales. He'll eat 2 of them and take the rest of them back to his hotel with him to eat over the next 2 weeks. You know, it's just the funniest thing.
So like everything in excess, kind of.
Yeah, pretty much.
That's funny, man.
Pretty much.
Good for him.
But I tell you what, he's an amazing artist. Just kind of impulsive sketch artist kind of thing.
Oh, you mean really?
I've got some things he's done for me. You know, like I'll be out working on something, I'll come in, he'll hand me this drawing he just did, you know, of, hey, take this with you, man. I've got a couple of them framed in my house that are just really cool, just kind of impulsive. He did them in 10 minutes kind of things, you know, with like one of them, he had some butcher paper and some white out and a black flare, and that was all he had, and did these drawings. And I'm like, man, that's so cool, you know.
That's awesome, man.
Yeah,
that's really nice.
Really, he's very much style and fashion. He's real in tune too.
You know what? In playing with him, he's one of these guys that he's not playing anything complicated. But man, does it feel good!
It does, and it's deceptive. I would contend that some of the stuff he plays on a song like Blue Jean Blues,
right?
Some of those intervals he's doing in the context of a straight blues tune are not typical at all. And some of those leaps, and it's like, that's pretty sophisticated right there. That ain't just your back porch foot stomping blues, you know?
Yeah.
He's got some depth in his compositional thing.
Definitely.
He really does.
But when I meant it's not complicated, it's not like technically, you know, like there's a big emphasis now on technique. And
no.
I'm of the old, I want to feel good. I don't care if it's got technique or not, great, but I want to feel something.
No, he kind of defines it in a weird kind of way.
Oh my God. I mean, yeah, just
it's deep. It is deep.
Look at that song that you just talked about, Blue Jean. What a great tune that is, man.
I mean, and stripped down butt naked too. There ain't nothing on that record. There ain't nothing on it. And you know, there've been some neat live recordings of them early on doing like Rattlesnake Shake and stuff like that, that popping up on YouTube. And man, you talk about a band breathing fire. Golly, Bill. I mean, they are just rending and tearing, man. It's just stunning.
I'm going to go look for some of those because I love the older stuff, man. Those first few albums are just magic.
Yeah.
38 Special, what'd you do with those guys?
Man, I did a couple of records with them. I did a record called Resolution with them in Memphis with Joe Hardy once again. And with Don Barnes, and Don was singing, and Danny Chauncey was in the band and doing a lot of the pre-production work and a lot of the writing and stuff, and Donnie Van Zandt. And I'm very proud of that record. I think it's a really good record. It's a little bit it's not as wholly commercial as you always think a 38 Special as being. It has a little extra oomph to it. But great guys, really sweet guys. And I wound up doing another record with them once I moved to Nashville. And I got to say, I can't recall if it ever actually came out or not. But I need to research that, see if it did. But they were always really good to work with and, you know, really sweet guys.
I meant to ask you, you did work with Jimmy Webb. Was Fred Mullen producing any of that?
Mm-hmm.
I had him on the show recently, and he's done so much work with Jim. I mean, they've been friends for like 30 or 40 years or something like
that. Yeah. Yeah. I've done a bunch of stuff with Fred. He's always got his hand in a really left of center stuff, you know?
Yeah.
Jimmy Webb stuff. I mean, he's you know, he's legendary. He's one of those guys. I mean, he's, you know, whew, that stuff he's written. And to get, you know, to get to play his songs with him.
Yeah, that's pretty cool, man.
It's very special. And I remember we had some actual real scores that we were playing to on that. And I had him sign a couple of them for me.
Oh, that's cool.
He was a real nice guy. You know, I think I had him sign a MacArthur Park and, you know, maybe another one.
That's nice, man. That's a classic song.
Ooh, no doubt.
Jorgensen, what'd you do with John? Talk about a monster player, man.
He is. I did one of his solo records. And I had thought of the title of it because I knew this would come up, and now I've forgotten the title of the solo record. I did two of them. He did when the flood hit in Nashville, you know, yeah. He lost a lot of instruments. And in the course of getting his instruments back, he wrote a piece of music with each of them.
Oh, that's cool.
So we recorded these albums that were inspired by, you know, and I think all the titles were, you know, 62 SG and things like that. You know, those were the titles of the song.
Yeah.
You know, because he wrote them as he got these instruments back together. He wrote them. And John and I, we met through Chuck Howard and Emotional Savant. That was the name of the solo record, I'm pretty sure. And it's just me and John, I think.
Oh, did he play bass?
I think he played everything else.
Yeah, he's a very talented guy, man.
Oh, man. He's such a sweet guy. And he and I hit it off really well. We had a bunch of things in common, you know, common tastes and things like that. And just, I don't know, we just found a kinship really, really early upon meeting with, you know, when we were doing some work for Chuck Howard. It's just kind of stayed away. I did one of his Guitar Town things with him, you know, there in Colorado.
Yeah.
And that was fun. And, you know, I've always had a good time playing with him.
It's funny. He mentioned when I had him here on the show, he said, you know, one of the reasons I always buy guitars is in line with what you just said. He goes, every time I buy a new guitar, I'm inspired to write a song or two. And I'm like, that's a real convenient thing to tell your wife. He goes, it is. It really is. But it's true in his case, you know. And he's such a talented guy. Seeger. How did that come up?
Well.
And what period of time was that?
I started with him in 2017.
Oh, so
this whole last thing was me.
Oh, I didn't know that. So you were out with Rob.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess, you know, it started with him seeing me playing in the house band on an ACM award show.
Oh,
it was one of the years where the ACM was going to have the winners of the studio musician categories, you know,
mm-hmm.
They were going to have them be the house band for the awards show. The one they do in Nashville, not the Vegas one, the one they do in Nashville.
Yeah.
Well, I didn't happen to win the ACM that year. Shannon Forrest won it, but he was not going to be able to play the show. So he asked me if I would sub for him. So I subbed for Shannon, and Jim Brown, who has been in Seeger's band for a long time. And I've known Jim forever. He's one of the first guys I worked with and met when I moved to town, known him for a long time. Anyway, he had been playing with Seeger. He was the band leader on the show.
Yeah. He was an MD, because I had him on here a long time. He's an MD for Seeger, too, I think, isn't he?
Essentially, yeah.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Bob really relies on him for a lot and trusts him, you know, implicitly, and which is good. But Jim's band leading for this TV show, so Bob's watching. You know, Bob's tuning in to see Jim. And so I don't really know what the impetus was that he was noticing me, but he called Jim and said, "No, I saw the TV show. Who's the drummer?" And Jim says, "Well, it's a guy, Greg Maher." He said, "I've actually mentioned him to you in the past." And he said, "Ah, okay. Well, good to know. Good to know." Well, a couple of weeks later, I got a phone call from Bill Blackwell from Seeger's office. He's putting together a session and wanted to know if I could do this session, a recording session. And I'm like, "Well, yeah, of course."
Yeah. It's Bob Seger.
I'd be honored. So that was a session was the first thing I ever did with him. We did this session, seemed to go really well. Seemed to be, you know, he's a really hardworking guy too, man. He just is all about it all the time. Yeah. I mean, he's just consumed with what he's doing. But anyway, we do this session, get it all done. About a month later, I get another phone call from Bill. Says, "Well, Bob would like to know if you ever considered, you know, doing any touring." And I'm like, "Well, I've always, you know, done touring as I could. And you know, if anyone would ask, you know, I'd always consider those kind of things." And he said, "Well, would you think you could come up and play, you know, play with the band and just see how it goes?" I'm like, "Yeah, I'd be glad to." So he said, "Well, I'll get Bob to send you some music and, you know, send you." So about a week later, I get these CDs in the mail, you know, and they're all handwritten from Bob, you know, titles and all this stuff. I'm like, "Well, that's pretty cool."
That is cool. Did he tell you which songs to focus on in particular?
Well, he sent me, I think, seven or eight things.
Okay.
Initially. And, you know, so I start woodshedding these things and, you know, and then I'm thinking to myself, you know what? I'm going to listen a little ahead of some of this stuff and just kind of guess at some other things we might do.
Right.
So I start gathering some other stuff and kind of charting some things. And sure enough, I get up there and we get ready to play and nothing he had sent me on the disc.
They didn't play any of it.
Didn't call any of them.
Oh my God!
The first hour, and it wasn't him being malicious. Hmm. He just gets something on his mind, and he just goes with it. He didn't have any more clue what he had sent me than anything. Right. And I ain't going to tell him, "Hey, Bob, you didn't send me that."
Right. Right. Yeah. Well, that's because sometimes they're going to do that on purpose.
Yeah, and that's not him. He's not going to do that. He just didn't remember. It had been a month at that point.
Yeah.
You know, but we had enough to get going. And I wanted it to feel like nothing was out of place when I went up there. Mm-hmm. You know, they had been having Don Brewer play with them for years and years. And he's one of my heroes.
Yeah.
A great drummer. And I didn't want anything to feel any less than it ever felt with, you know, with Donnie or anybody else. I didn't want anything to be amiss at all. I didn't want to leave any doubt, you know? So I worked really hard on that. And I think we achieved that. I think when I went in and played, there were a lot of smiles and that
That's
made,
great, man.
It made me feel really good that they were like, "Oh crap, let's go play. Can we book a gig this weekend?"
That's, you know, awesome, man.
Book a gig now.
And you're the only guy probably not from the Midwest, because he's heavy into, like, where do you come from?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like McNelly and Mark, they're from Chatfield, Ohio. Moose is like a Detroit guy, if I remember
correctly. Well, he was born there, but he was raised in Jonesboro.
Right, but everybody has this Midwest. I know Seeger's big on that Midwest connection, man.
Yeah, he is. Yeah. He is.
Well, that's cool, man.
But he also, you know, some of his "Come to Papa" was a big Memphis record, and "Trying to Live My Life Without You" was a big Memphis record.
Mm. Okay, so you had that connection there.
You know, with Ike and Tina Turner, you know, that's Nutbush, Tennessee is 20 miles from where I grew up.
Right.
You know, right. Place, you know. And so, you know, he's got that element about him, too. He knows that. So
that's great. And that was a fantastic tour.
Man, I got to tell you, to have gotten to do something like that at this point in my career arc, as they say, was just, I can't tell you, man. It was just stunning. It was just stunning. And the band, I just felt like the band just really, really played really well every night and brought it for him. And it was, you know, and consequently he, you know, it raised his bar and, you know what I mean? Mm. And it was just a real, it was no computers, no tracks, no stems, no nothing. If you heard it, someone up there was playing it.
That's great, man.
There's no assist at all. You know, it was every note of it was played and sang by the people you saw on stage. And that's a rare commodity these days.
Oh yeah. Is he, do you think he's done or is he going to be coming out again sometime or?
I couldn't speculate.
Yeah. I know he had that.
I hope in my heart that there's more that we could do just cause it was so fun. I would certainly understand if he just decided he was done, but I don't know. He never struck me. I think music has been everything in his life, all of his life. And I have a hard time imagining him not creating on some level or not wanting to perform because it's been his very existence.
Yeah.
And so I don't know. I have a hard time accepting it, but yet I kind of have to accept it because that's what they've all said at this point.
Right, right. Well, hopefully, fingers crossed, man, you'll be out again with them.
Yeah, that'd be great.
And, man, one of my favorite players, Warren Haynes. What'd you do with Warren? He's supposed to come on here. He's aware of the show. He wants to come on. He's just so busy. I probably should reach out to them again now because nobody's busy.
Yeah, no one's doing anything right now.
In fact,
Warren's a great guy. And the first time I ever met Warren, there's an engineer in town in Memphis named Jeff Powell. And he had been around Warren, I think, when Dowd was producing the Allman Brothers records that Warren played on. And they became buddies. And Jeff had to do some kind of project for a college course. And so he had talked to Warren about coming to Arden and doing three or four songs for this college course and had to put a band together and asked me to play on it. And so that's where I met Warren the first time. And once again, it was kind of like Jorgensen. We just hit it off and became friends and had a great time. And probably, I don't know, it was probably a couple of years after that, he had signed, to do his solo deal. I can't remember if it was Megaforce or what label it was on. It was on an Atlantic subsidiary, I think. But it was that Tales of Ordinary Madness.
Yeah, what a great. He doesn't make any bad music, that guy.
No, he doesn't.
He doesn't play any bad notes. He's an incredible writer. I mean, he's just super talented dude.
Yeah. I mean, he was making his bones writing before any of all that.
Yeah.
Anyway, I was still living in Memphis and I got a call from him and you know, he was going to use his live band on half the record, but he wanted to bring me and Johnny Neal and Michael Rhodes in to play on the other half of the record. And I had never met Michael at the time. It's the first time I'd ever seen Michael or Johnny for that matter. And Chuck Lavelle was, I think, producing or co-producing this record with him. So we went to Atlanta and worked on that record. And, you know, once again, it was one of those experiences that puts you, you know, where you're meeting people you've grown up hearing, you know, like Chuck and then meeting people that you've heard about with Rhodes and Johnny Neal. And, you know, the first time Michael and I ever played together, it was like he walked into my brain and knew everything I was going to do before I ever hit anything.
He's a talented guy, man.
I'm trying to think of the proper word for it. It's just like he knows what's coming. You know, you have that communication with another player, and he and I have that on a level not like most. Rick Nadello and I have it too, but Rhodes and I, even with Bonamassa, you know, someone that I don't play with on a regular basis. I only come in when Anton's out of kilter, you know, like if he's got something else he's got to do, or like when he broke his ankle or something like that. But even then, you know, I'll walk in and it's just like we're playing these songs like we've been playing them for 5 years, you know, and it's just something. The intuition, I guess, is what I'm saying.
That's the magic of that when you get that with somebody, man.
Yeah. That's so cool. Those gigs are so fun because it's basically a 4-piece band with two horns and some singers. You know, so there's lots of room to roam. And sometimes the challenge is not to roam too far.
Sure.
Because you got guys that can really go on and it's much more interesting hearing them roam than me roam.
Well, that's because you're a pro, man, and you serve the songs.
Foundationally, you know, there's got to be a foundation, and that makes everything else have its space, and that's what's fun about that is getting to kind of lay the cinder block so they can put the trim work on.
So you're on half of Tales of Ordinary Madness.
I am. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's cool. Did you play with him after that at all?
No.
What, any cool or funny or interesting Warren stories?
You know, not really. Our relationship has just always been very friendly and cordial and pretty matter of fact.
Yeah.
You know, we're not together enough really to have had those kind of moments.
Sure. I guess.
So it's kind of tough.
Totally get it.
Yeah.
That's nice, man. Is there any other gigs that you'd like to chat about that were cool or that you have fond memories of? Or
man, one in particular.
Yeah.
With Sonny Landreth, I will tell you. When South About 10 came out, we did a flurry of dates, and we had 2 weeks booked at the Chesterfield Cafe in Paris.
Oh, man.
And man, you talk about getting to plant someplace for 2 weeks, man, the shows just get more intense and more intense as they go. And man, by the time those 2 weeks were up, it was brutal, you know, how good it was. And Sonny, you know, he's such a, you know, you hear him talking, you hear him sing, and it's kind of a tender voice and all of this stuff. I guess he's a gentle soul, you know, but man, what's coming out of him is just like,
yeah, he can tear it up, man. Yeah.
And Dave Ranson, Steve Kahn was playing keyboards, and Steve, Steve is hilarious. And he was learning, he was telling himself he was learning these phrases to speak to the audience in French. And man, every time he would try it, he was just met with stone silence. it was just cruel. We would just look at each other and just go, man.
Oh, he was learning a phrase to chat with girls in French.
Yeah.
That's so funny.
It's not working for you at all. That was a special time because that I'm really proud of what I got to do on that record. I shared that record with Kenny Blevins. There's a couple of things we played on together on that record, but we cut it down in Maurice, Louisiana, and it was an amazing experience. Bobby Fields, you know, produced it. And, you know, Sonny's just Sonny, man. He's that Delta. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. He's got it in his soul. Yeah, for sure, man.
He does.
What an unusual name. You said it's the Chesterfield Cafe in Paris.
Yeah.
What an unusual name of a club in Paris, no?
Well, I think they kind of, it was kind of set up to be a club to showcase American music, I think.
Yeah, that was it, from that perspective, it's smart.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a smart thing. But
it was right there on the boulevard, the Champs-Élysées or whatever that main road is right there, you know?
That's cool, man. Did you like Paris?
I did. You know, it was this has been, oh gosh, it was early 90s when we were there. So, you know, I'm sure Paris has changed quite a lot since then. But I remember I took the subway. I went out to Morrison's grave and,
oh, that's cool.
Did all that. And, you know, Steve Kahn and I wound up hanging out the most in Paris. Just for whatever reason, it just worked out that way.
Yeah.
We run around a lot. Every time I would go to Europe or London in particular, at the time, you know, record stores were still big business. And, you know, I'd always come back with just sacks and sacks full of, you know, European pressings and stuff and European versions.
Yeah, that used to be cool. You get these bootlegs that they don't have here. Yeah, that was cool. I spent a lot of time in record stores as a kid, man. This is a tough question. Knee-jerk reaction. Top three experiences you've had musically.
Oh, that changes daily.
I get it. Just for now, whatever you're feeling right now.
Well, you know, getting playing Pine Knob in the summer in Michigan, 3 weeks running with Seeger, sold out every night. You know, it can't possibly get much better than that. It's because so much of this is fresh in my memory. Playing the LA Forum with him. Because when I was a kid, I was a big Three Dog Night fan, and one of my favorite records was Captured Live at the Forum.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you hear LA Forum, LA Forum, LA Forum. You just think that's, you know, and Madison Square Garden, the inside of the Closer to Home record, you know, is Grand Funk at Madison Square Garden.
Right.
I played both of those buildings on that Seeger tour. You know, so
it's a pretty cool. That's a pretty cool bucket list to check off.
Well, it is. It is. And you know, I got to say, one of the ones that I have that was really fun and special in a crazy way, it was a substitute gig. I was actually subbing for Michael Cardelloni with Skinner. I got a call from him, and I'd known Ricky Medlock from years ago with Blackfoot. They used to come through Memphis all the time. I used to go see them in clubs in Memphis. So I knew Ricky well. And at this point I had worked on a couple of Skinner records up to then. Anyway, I get a call from their management, and they said, Michael has a European vacation booked with his family that they've had booked for a year. And the University of Florida has called and wants Skinner to come play homecoming at the Swamp at University of Florida football stadium.
That's a weird request.
They want Skinner to come. And they said, man, do you think you could ever do something like that? I'm like, well, yeah, yeah, I'd be glad. You know, first of all, I'm glad to help out. I'm, you know, glad to,
yeah,
you know, understand, you know, Michael's got this vacation book with his family and, you know, but yeah, I'd love to do it. And so we go down there and, you know, once again, I'm playing stuff I've known all my life.
Yeah.
You know, but I mean, when you're there and Gary's over there and Billy Payne was still living, you know, and he's playing keys and you're just looking around and you're, you know, man, I saw Skinner just kill Eric Clapton at the stadium in Memphis in 74. Just him. And I mean, I'm on, you know,
yeah.
Everybody's going to say, well, it ain't really Skinner. Well, it's as much a Skinner as you can have.
Yeah. At that time. Absolutely.
It's still part of the legacy. And believe me, they take it very seriously.
Yeah.
You know, regardless of what you think about it, they take it very seriously. And man, when we hit the stage in that stadium, they went nuts. I mean, they went crazy because that's their backyard, you know, Jackson Gainesville and all that stuff. And I mean, I played the Full Tilt Monty Freebird down to the Bolero ending with Skynyrd in Florida at the Florida Homecoming.
That's so cool, man.
It was very cool. It was very cool.
Yeah, that's nice, man. All right, so Seeger, Skynyrd, what would be number three?
Oh, gosh. I would say Rodney Crowell was one of the first guys I wound up working with in Nashville. And Rodney's my neighbor now. I'm sitting here looking at his driveway right now.
That's funny.
But he called one day. He said, man, I got a special song I want to do. He said, can you just come in and do this one song? I'm like, well, yeah, man, I'd be glad to. He said, I ain't going to tell you about it. I'll just, we'll show up. We'll just work it up. We'll do this song. So come to the studio and he said, this is a song called Walk the Line Revisited. And I'm like, cool. He said, yeah, it's about the first time I ever heard I Walk the Line on my dad's car radio. He said, it just left such a mark on me. And so we start working this song up, and then I notice a little kerfluffle kind of in the other part of the room, and Johnny Cash has walked in.
Holy smokes.
And he said, oh, by the way, I didn't tell you, but Johnny's going to sing the choruses on this song. And he goes out Wow. and gets in his room, puts the headphones on, and I'm playing this song, and we get to the chorus, and there's Johnny's voice in my headphones. I keep a close watch on, and I'm just losing my cookies.
That's so awesome, man.
Being from Memphis, Sun Records, you could buy Sun Records at any dime store, convenience store, anywhere in West Tennessee, because it was right there. They just take them in the trunk of their car and drop them off.
Yeah, like magazines.
Yeah, it was a rat jobber, they would call them.
Yeah.
So they were just everywhere. Everybody had all the Sun Records. Everybody had them. It was big doings back then. So, yeah, we were so steeped in all of that, And I remember I ran home at lunch or something, and I had my grandmother's copy of a 78 of Get Rhythm, and I brought it back up, and he signed it for me.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's cool, man.
Yeah. It was very cool.
Did you ever get to play with Reggie? I had the late Reggie Young here.
I did.
You did? Because he was out of Memphis, I know.
Yeah, he's an Arkansas boy originally.
Yeah.
But, yeah, his bones were cut there at American. And actually at Royal, when he was doing Bill Black's combo stuff, prior to all the American stuff, he was doing those instrumental dance records with Bill Black's combo that basically they were just being made to serve as jukeboxes because that was a very incestuous business that they had a studio, they had Popper Tunes record shop, and they also had the vending business.
Oh, so wow.
They would cut their own records to put on their own jukeboxes.
That's clever as hell.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. Thanks, man. Some really good stories you shared. I appreciate that. Greg, any low points? Or tell me about the low points that you've had to deal with in life and how'd you get through them?
You know what? I just let them roll on by and I don't dwell on them. The low points are always, when you lose someone. I lost my dad when I was still a pretty young man. I was 40. And he was a really young man and died way before his time. Low points are generally stuff like that.
Yeah.
When, family that has cared for you and you've cared for and y'all have loved each other growing up and had each other for all those years, when they're not in your physical presence anymore, you have to find a way to, you have to allow their presence to stay with you.
It's all right, man. Take your time.
And I have, I have a lot of those presents. I'm sorry.
No, man. There's nothing to...
that I carry with me, you know, that stay with me. They do stay with me. And they have stayed with me. And that keeps it from being so low. But I'm grateful for that.
Man, I'm glad you have those great memories to hang on, man.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is great.
Yeah.
You have kids, right?
One daughter.
Yeah,
one daughter.
How old
she'll be 30 this year.
Yeah, she's the same age as my oldest son, you know.
Yeah.
And it's funny because I don't know if you've experienced this, but I could tell my son is kind of now aware of the fact that I'm not going to be here forever. And, you know, he's been very tender. And I mean, there's no reason, thank God, you know, I'm not that I know of, there's nothing going on, but I noticed that in him. And it's a nice feeling that I'm sad that he even has to think about that, but it's a nice feeling to know that that he has a feeling about that.
Well, that he has an appreciation of the relationship and wants to make the best of that.
Yes, that's eloquently put.
You don't want to dwell on inevitabilities like that.
Hell no.
But yeah, you do have to appreciate the here and now and what's here in your hand.
You know? So important, man. That's like the most important thing.
Yeah, it is. It is very important.
Thank you, man. I appreciate you sharing that.
Okay.
This is a tough question. Favorite musicians you've enjoyed playing with? You can probably put me in an encyclopedia worth.
Yeah, boy, that's just, oh gosh. I don't know that there's ever been anybody I haven't enjoyed. That sounds like a cop out.
No, I understand.
It's not a cop out because you get something every time. You get something every time you sit with someone and share that dialogue. There's something there,
yeah.
And you pick up something. Gosh, I don't even know. You know, I would say probably Sonny, just because I'm so constantly amazed at what he can do, and that he can play like that and sing like that and write like that all at the same time. I think Sonny's one of those ones, you know, it's just a different level. And he's been so true to what he does, you know. So I guess from that standpoint, you know, he's certainly one of them. Pat McLaughlin as well. On, you know, we do shows with Pat outside of the headliners that's all his material. And his band is a really special band with Kenny Greenberg and Michael Rhodes and he and myself. And sometimes Chad plays with him too. You know, Chad's done a number of things with Pat. And I think he would probably say the same thing, that band is a pretty special little outfit.
Top, again, knee-jerk reaction just for now. Top three Desert Island discs.
Man, he's gonna have a lot of dead air to edit out here.
No, it's all. You know what? I'll tell you. I always think of this. This guy emailed me one time, a listener, and he said, "He goes, I love how when you ask your guest about the low points in their life." They freely tell you about, you know, family loss, addiction, getting sober, stressful financial things. But when you ask them their three favorite records, they are tied up in knots. And I always think of that. That's very accurate.
Yeah, it's an honest to God truth.
It's a tough question, man.
It's tough. Because, you know, you have the things that were so formative to you that you wouldn't be yourself without. But yet, you know, maybe they're not absolutely the things you would listen to when, if you only had three to rotate between.
Yeah.
You know, it would be tough. I'm going to answer this. So just give me a minute.
No, it's all good, man.
I would put probably ZZ Top Tres Hombres in there, just because it's such an amazingly well done, basic, face shredding rock album.
Amazing, sure is.
Okay. Let's see. That's one. Probably the UK version of the Beatles Revolver, because it has things on it that the American version doesn't have, and it makes a more cohesive picture. Just because I can't accept not having it around. There's a collection of, it's called Little Richard's 17 Original Grooviest Hits.
And it's, great name.
It's the original specialty recordings of his singles.
Grooviest, you know,
not re-records or anything like that. It's the original recordings. And man, there's just nothing. There's nothing more exciting than Ready Teddy, or you know, Good Golly Miss Molly, or Keep a Knockin'. It's just, I mean, the sheer force of that. You just got to have that.
Anything with the word grooviest hits is a good record in my mind.
Yeah. And, you know, that will change.
Oh, yeah. This is, yeah. See, this is why people hire you, though, man. You're a man who gives 100%. That was commitment on that question. And that's what, no, but how you do one thing is how you do everything, man. So, like, that, seriously, that's how shit works, right? You know, you're either like, in 100% or you're not, and you're in 100%, yeah. Man. Thank you. That was great. Another tough question, man. What do you like most about yourself?
I really work hard at not holding a grudge.
That's really great.
Because that just weighs you down.
100%. Yeah, you know, forgiveness, I always thought it was for the other person. It's not.
Mm-mm.
It's for you.
It's as much for you.
Yeah. Certainly. For sure. Most important thing your dad taught you.
Boy, that's a tough one, because we had a very unusual relationship.
Or most important thing you learn. Sometimes you learn like not what not to do.
It was more that.
Yeah, that's important.
It was more that. So it was kind of by default.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was kind of by default.
How about your mom? Most important thing she taught you.
Probably the human version of unconditional love. You know, there's the godly version of that, but there's also person to person, you know, mother to daughter to son to father to,
yeah,
you know, whatever. Loving your people unconditionally, whoever your people are.
That's the number one answer
it's,
for that question.
Yeah, it's tough because sometimes those people get themselves into situations it's really hard to love them through. I mean, and self-inclusive. Yeah. You know, sometimes I behave in ways that I would think makes it hard for anybody to love me that way.
Yeah, that's why that word unconditional, that's what, yeah.
Yeah, and man, I've seen it on levels that I'm not sure I could execute. You know, I've seen it in other people's lives, and I'm just going, oh man, how? Whew. You know, but it's there.
Do you have any hobbies outside of music or interests?
I've always enjoyed motorcycles and cars. Not like hot rods or anything like that, but just like, you know, 50s automobilia, that kind of stuff. I do some fabricating drum work wise, you know. I like the building aspect of it. And I have historically done quite a lot of that when I worked at a shop in Memphis. And we did a bunch of custom work for a lot of people. And that's always a nice diversion, just operating different sides of your brain. And one of the things I've liked about home recording so much, I've always had studios ever since I was a teenager. I've been involved in studios on one level or another. And working on music from that side of things, you know, it gives you a whole nother well of stuff to pull from. And how you treat your instrument, how you tune and sounds and blah, 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 blah. You know, when you're facing it from the other side of the window.
Sure.
Different ball game, but you're also just working other areas of your brain, and I enjoy that.
Right on, man. Two more questions, Greg. And, man, you're a joy to talk to. Thank you so much for everything.
Oh, man, thank you. You're welcome.
Biggest change in your personality over the last 10 years, and how much of that has been intentional and how much is a natural part of aging?
Changing my personality. I'd like to think that I've gotten a little less self-centered. That was my dog, Levon. You heard that.
No, I didn't hear it. Name from Levon Helm.
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, his name's Ramblin' Levon.
Right on, man.
He is named for Levon Helm. But I think as you have children and they grow up and they, you know, I think the natural thing is to become more, become more centered on them and trying to help them and get them along. And I think that takes a little of the self-emphasis off. And then I think you just learn eventually that it kind of is more fulfilling on some level to be not always taking, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And at least trying to give something to somebody, you know. Or something to something, but putting out instead of just always gathering. And I say that as I have, you know, a room full of drums and guitars and stuff and all that stuff upstairs. But, you know, that's my trade. But
I think you're talking about more like emotionally putting out or support wise, caring and.
I just know that there's going to be that factor. Well, yeah, but you got all this stuff and blah, 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 blah. You know, people are going to say that.
No, but that's not the context. I don't think you were talking about it. I mean, what's wrong with having stuff? That doesn't mean like, you know.
Yeah, you just don't let the stuff doesn't possess you.
Yeah, right. Well, last question, and I will tell you, you've given me a lot here, so thank you. You've done that. And you might have just answered it. And the question was, most important lesson that life has taught you?
Ooh. You just got to pay attention. You have to pay attention to it. And it's worth paying attention to.
Yeah, man.
because this aspect of it is finite, and it's an amazing, you know, blessing to have.
Absolutely,
drawing breath on this earth, and getting to share experiences with people. I don't know. That's one of the things I'm most grateful about. You know, for me, there was never any question ever in my life that this was going to be my path. And I think that gets back to the faith thing. I just wandered off down this path, hopefully with open minds and an open heart, and tried to stay out of trouble and just do a good job with the opportunities that came my way and appreciate them and pay attention to them. And that's why this has led me to right here, right now. It's just trying to pay attention.
Man, I think you've done a good job listening. by all standards, man.
I appreciate it. I'll spend the rest of the afternoon pondering all of this.
could be worse. Hey, man, let me tell people where to find you. First of all, thank you, man. You're a lovely guy. You're very sincere, and I really appreciate it. And you did give me a gift today, so thanks, man.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you asking me to do this. It's not something I get asked to do very often, but.
I don't know why, man. You're great at it. You should be doing these all day. You should be freaking speaking.
Well, it's like I told you when we were getting started. I always figure out something that I'm needing to know.
Yeah,
you know, there's always something comes up at the top. It's like, oh boy, yeah, I needed to be reminded of that. So that's good.
Well, cool, man. Let me tell people where to start. Where to find it. It's Greg Morrow, man. He is not all over the internet, but, you know, if you want to connect with Greg, one thing I really would like you to do, man, he has made a commitment to start posting on Instagram. So what? I would like everybody listening, just grab your phone and go to Instagram, and it's Greg Morrow 45, and it's a picture of Greg as a Simpsons character, which is another story, but follow him on there, man, and then tell him, hey, man, I heard you on Everyone Loves Guitar. I loved your interview.
And tell me where the caption window is.
Tell him where the caption window is. No, but follow Greg on Instagram. That would be really cool. Look, he's got a home studio. He's always worked out of a home studio. And in fact, he did most of the stuff for Billy F. Gibbons' solo records out of that. If you want to have Greg play with you or do some tracks, or if you're looking for some consulting or guidance on rhythm stuff or putting that aspect of whatever you're doing together, send him an email. I'm going to give you his email address. Please just don't disrespect that. He's busy like all of us are. And if you do email him, just let him know, hey, I heard your interview and, you know, here's what I've got going on and here's why I think you'd be a good fit. And I'd like your help with the following things. Just be specific so he can answer you in a reasonable manner. His email is Gringo Star. It's like Ringo Star, two R's at the end with a G. So it's Gringo, GRINGOSTARR at mac.com. And also on eBay, he's got a bunch of CDs with the world famous headliners. If you go on there, if you want to buy a CD from him on there, email him and tell him you're going to buy a CD, give him your email address or whatever, but he'll sign it for you if you'd like that. So let him know a heads up. And again, Instagram, Greg Morrow 45. Oh, you want to blow this guy's Instagram. He's going to be like an influencer like by the time this is over. Anything I forgot or anything else you want to mention?
No, man. Thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity.
It's honestly my pleasure. Hang on a sec. Let me wrap this up and thank you for everything. Everybody, thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this, please share it on your social media channels. We appreciate your support. Thank you very much to Greg Morrow. Again, if you're interested in working with him and helping him, having him help you with tracks, whether it's laying them down or giving you some consulting or guidance on putting them together, email him at gringo, G-R-I-N-G-O, star with two R's at mac.com. Anyway, man, thank you. And everybody, listen, especially in these times, remember most importantly that happiness really is a choice. So choose wisely. Be nice, go play your guitar or your drums, and just enjoy life and have fun. Till next time, peace and love, everybody. I am out. Greg, thank you so much, brother.
Thank you. See ya.
We hope you enjoyed this show. If you did, subscribe to the Everyone Loves Guitar podcast, and you can do this online at everyonelovesguitar.com or on iTunes. And if you like the show, please leave us a 5-star positive review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the higher our show ranks, and higher rankings mean we get to continue speaking with cool, interesting guests on our show. We'll see you on the next episode, and until then, keep playing your guitar and have fun making music.